I decide not to add that the thought of them gluing those fertilized eggs into me makes me feel physically sick. I can stay. Mother Cardi extends a hand for me to take. She helps me to my feet and follows me through to the bathroom. While I'm undressing, she turns on the shower, checking the temperature, then picks up the dirty clothes I've been wearing and puts them into the laundry bin. I didn't shower last night. When we first left the safe room, I was intending to, but those plans vanished once I found my mother's note. I walk into the shower, closing my eyes as the hot water hammers at my body, waking me fully. I keep my eyes closed as Mother Cardi applies shampoo to my hair while sitting on the ledge above me, massaging it into my scalp. She rinses it, then smooths on the conditioner. She's about to climb down and leave me to wash it out myself, but I sense her hovering next to me, as though she's waiting for something. I open my eyes as she reaches out to cradle my cheek. "You're stronger than you know, Eve," she whispers. "And your mother was too. Trust your instincts. Follow them." My eyes squint at her through the water running over my face. She glances at the shower, then at one of the microphones hanging above us. It can't hear us over the noise of running water, and we can't be seen, thanks to the steam on the glass. Not if we're careful. Yet before I have a chance to say or ask anything in return, she's gone to fetch a towel from the heated rack. The moment is gone. I search her face when I get out of the shower, but there is nothing to read. It's as though I've imagined the exchange.
Chapter 46. Bram. Once the laughter dies down, the Freevers look at me with the strangest mixture of expressions, some confused, others angry, but Frost's face is unreadable. He keeps his cards close to his chest. He raises a hand, and the whispers hush. "Lead us," he says calmly. "Where exactly are you planning to lead us, Bram?" I pick up the photograph from the table and walk through the crowd to where the projector sits. I slip the photo of our first kiss off the light plate and replace it with this photo. The projected tree fills the center of the room, and the men step back out of its light. "I'm leading a rescue mission for Ernie Warren, here." I point to the brick building sitting in the tree shade. There are murmurs and whispers from every Freever in the room as they stare at the photograph before them. I glimpse Helena's long gray hair and see her still batting off the whisperers around her, asking her opinion. She tilts her head, waiting to hear more from me.
"And what makes you think this is the place?"
calls a thin voice from the back.
"Of all the hundreds of thousands of locations where he could be, of all the possible photographs on the table, you just happen across the one photo of his whereabouts."
The rabble immediately erupt, firing more questions in my direction. Frost remains a silent observer of the chaos.
"Listen,"
I calm them with my hands, but it's not enough to silence them. I step up onto the bench at the table, raising myself so I can see the whole room and they can see me.
"Listen to me. You've been searching for years with no luck. Yes, I know it sounds hard to believe that I would walk in here and pick up this photo, but it's even crazier for me to find it here."
The room of damp people quietens as they pause for a moment to listen.
"Or maybe it's not crazy. Maybe it's meant to be. Maybe I was meant to be here to find this photograph because I know one thing for sure. There isn't anyone else in the world who would know that this is the place, not anyone on your side anyway. You've only known me a short time, but you're just going to have to trust me. It's too important for you not to. I've spent nearly my entire life up there, inside that tower, working to keep their lie alive, staring into Eve's eyes, delivering their messages, getting Eve to cooperate with their demands, and she would do it for me every time. Why? I hold up the photo of our kiss. Because Eve trusts me, more than she trusts anyone else, and that's why you should too. That's why you have to. For Eve."
I have the room's attention. Helena raises her eyebrows, impressed, I think, with my speech.
"This is where Eve's father is, I know it. I've looked at this photo more than any other image and only just realized what it is."
"What are you going to do with him when you find him?" asks Chubbs.
"Are you out of your mind? He's not going to be there. He's dead,"
calls one of the older men of the group, starting a series of exchanges about my spontaneous plan to lead them on a search for Eve's long-lost father.
What if he's lying? What if he's just another EPO spy?
Cries another one of the more mature men.
What if he isn't?
Helena says, her raspy voice demanding people listen.
What if he's right?
The heads in the room turn to her, but her powerful gaze is fixed on me.
This kid could be everything we've ever wanted.
There is a silence as they absorb her words.
If we're ever going to have a shot at finding him, surely it's with Bram, Saunders adds clumsily. How can we trust him? What if he's just luring us into a trap?
The noise erupts again, reaching an unbearable volume.
Frost stands up, his arms raised. Silence falls over the room, and I realize he owns these people. It's not them I need to convince. It's him. He turns to me, looks me in the eye, and I can see the cogs of his mind working.
Look, I say to him, I want to get Eve out of that place as much as all of you, but I've got to know the truth, and Ernie is the key. I know it. If he's still alive, this is where we can find him.
Okay, Bram, says Frost.
Silence. Stunned silence.
Okay, I reply.
Let's do this your way. You call the shots. You want to lead this bunch? They're all yours.
The room twitches silently. I can feel the discomfort his decision causes.
For real? I ask.
For Eve, he replies. I nod in agreement and reach out to shake his hand.
For Eve,
the room shouts in unison, some voices more reluctantly than others. Frost takes a seat and ties his thick dreadlocks behind his head.
So, Bram, what's the plan?
The pods are loaded with supplies, mainly weapons. We leave through the broken glass of Ben as weak sunlight turns the pollution clouds from thick purple to heavy grey.
You sure you know what you're doing? Saunders asks, stepping into the pod I'm waiting in.
Nope, I say honestly, but if there's a chance I'm right, we've got to take it, yes? Before he has a chance to reply, Frost steps into the pod behind us.
Ready when you are, Captain, he says.
He pulls the hood of his deep green waterproof jacket over his matted locks and awaits my orders.
We've planned for this as best we can. It was Helena who realized it might be a sanctuary, meaning that it's kept well hidden, protected. But that information at least narrowed the search. If Eve's father is there, it's a clever move from the EPO, hiding a man in a place no men are allowed to go to.
Smart. The kind of thing my father would have thought of.
Whether this place is still standing is another question. The most recent charts of that area are all BE, pre-flood. It could be in ruins now, but my gut says differently. All that's left is to go and find out, to see if I'm right, or if I'm leading Frost rebels on a wild goose chase.
I know that not all of you are comfortable with this mission, but I thank you for your commitment to me, I say, sounding far too rehearsed.
It's Eve we're committed to, dumbass, says a young blonde Freever from the second of the three pods we're taking out.
I see Chubbs elbow him in the ribs to shut him up.
He's right. It's Eve we're all committed to. Let's go and find her father.
I nod at Saunders, and he eases the throttle forward. We cruise out onto the open river where I see the city alive for the first time.
I can't believe how busy it is. So different from the night I arrived.
There are large boats, almost ships, moored to the rooftops of sunken buildings. Men walking along gangplanks suspended hundreds of feet over the water, bridging the gap between building and boat. Pretty amazing how fast they built these, Saunders says, noticing my eyes gazing up at Central.
I'd forgotten what this place was like. Vast structures attached to the old buildings, like sitting on the shoulders of a drowning man, soaring towards the sky.
Square buildings that tower over the rivers flowing between them. These new cloud scrapers weren't designed to look nice, just to withstand the storms and provide homes so life could go on. And life did go on, surprisingly normally, considering what happened. I take in the sights and smells all around as we sail north over Regent's Lake. Men out here look happy. I see men chatting, kissing, men drinking coffee simulants, reading the news on their hollow players on their way to work as they tread the weather-beaten pathways of this place. No women, of course. It's not safe enough for the few who remain to leave the female-only communities. I guess the women of the deep are living outside the EPO law. Another reason to stay hidden. Everything sits about 10 feet above the current waterline, allowing for the flood level to rise, which it will, Saunders tells me, shaking his head. They might have stopped dropping bombs, but the oceans didn't stop rising. Our pod is rocked by the wake of a larger ship cruising past us in the opposite direction.
I'd keep your head low if I were you, kid.
Frost radios over the intercom from his pod, and as the ship passes us, I see why. On the side of its black hull, the words cold storage are printed in large white letters. A blue light flashes on top, signaling other boats to clear out of its way. Armed guards pace the top deck, wearing the EPO's security uniform under the same black body armor as Ketch's men. Deliveries to the tower? I ask, and Saunders nods. A cold vapor pours from the back like a heavy steam that sits on the surface of the water. I watch the huge ship sail in the direction of my old home and wonder how many women it's carrying, all headed towards their prestigious place in the depths of the tower, beside my mother. I instinctively reach for the silver cross around my neck. As the EPO ship disappears between buildings, I follow the furthest structure upwards. I strain my neck and see the enormous reality TV screen strapped to the sides, my father's tech. I can't escape him. It's like he's looking down on me wherever I go.
They used to pump out constant updates on Eve, Frost's deep voice says over the intercom. Everyone watched. We'd all gather out here for the latest news, to see how the Savior was getting on, what she was doing from one day to the next. It gave everyone hope, made us remember what we were living for, that we had a planet to protect for our kids.
As we sail out over the open stretch of water, I look back at the city skyline. Every building covered from top to bottom with screens.
Who wouldn't want a glimpse of the girl who was going to save humanity from extinction? Frost says.
I knew they showed people what was happening, but not that it was like this, I say.
It's like some reality show.
Are you kidding? Your girlfriend was the biggest reality TV star on the planet once, Saunders jokes.
Once? I ask.
Yeah. Until they decided we weren't important anymore, that it was better keeping secret what goes on up there, Frost explains. They shut down the live streams from the dome, just gave us momentary glimpses of Eve when it suited them. Mostly doctored footage and faked images. We all knew they weren't real from the moment they started. Suddenly the screens flicker to life. Three huge letters illuminate the fine mist that hangs in the air like fog. E-O-M. E-O-M? I ask. Eve of Man, Saunders explains. That's what they've branded her. They want us to think she's our Eve.
We just get this propaganda shit now, that's all. Whatever the EPO want us to see, whatever they think is going to keep us all in line, Frost tells me from his pod, sailing along to my left. It's about keeping the powerful powerful and the rest of us? Well, who cares? Eve's just their poster girl. We'd pull the screens down if they weren't protected.
Protected, I ask. Yeah, they're all solar panels. Those screens feed us lies and give us energy. They power the whole city. Can't live without them, so we gotta put up with this crap, Saunders says. Pretty clever. It would have been another of my father's genius ideas. It's got him written all over it. Here we go, says Saunders, pointing to the video that begins to play across the surface of every building around us. Eve picks flowers in her garden inside the dome. Cut to Eve exercising, sweat dripping from her chin. Then she gracefully plies at the bar in her ballet shoes. Now she's drinking green juice. A deep voiceover booms out, echoing across the lake.
Eve is working hard, preparing for the future, for your future. She is your savior. She is Eve of Man.
Eve stands on the drop alone, looking out at the sunset. This is all old footage, I tell Saunders. Yeah, we know, he says. They recut these things all the time, flip the images around, change the camera angles, anything to make it seem new and fresh. We rarely get any current glimpses of her. The three large letters, E-O-M,
glare out at us one last time before the screen fades to black. I turn away and look ahead to where the open stretch of water narrows. I hear that deep voice echo in my mind and can't help but wonder if I'm prepared for the future. I guess I'm about to find out.
Chapter 47. Eve. She's staying with me, I say firmly, as I enter the clinical examination room with Mother Cardi at my side. My chaperoning mother is usually sent away, told she isn't needed within these walls, but today Mother Cardi is needed. By me. I need her comfort, her kindness, her compassion, her presence. Vivian's eyes dart between us as though she's trying to work out if I'm up to something, but she seems to dismiss the idea with an exasperated sigh. Very well. Glad you're feeling up to speaking, Eve, she smirks. I see you've been eating too. Good, good. Ignoring her jibes, I stand by the metal chair in the corner of the room, stripping off my clothes. Then Mother Cardi helps me into the garment laid out for me, a blue hospital gown. I thought about saying something before this process took place. I debated whether or not to go to Vivian and tell her I'd changed my mind and didn't want it to happen in this way, but I know that would give her the upper hand and an inkling of what's going on in my head. I'd have to give reasons, and I didn't want that. I didn't want to tell her that I'm doubtful of what they've given me as a reality. I have to be sure of the truth first. It's the same reason I've not spoken to her about Bram and Holly. Anyway, I'm not sure how much it matters now he's gone. She wouldn't let him be my potential. I'm certain that if I asked, she'd refuse and mock me because I've fallen for him. She'd resort to belittling our love as a childish crush. I know what we have is far more than that. I'd have loved Bram and Holly regardless of their form. Part of me would be happy to keep things as they have been, with us out on the drop forevermore. That's how much he, has affected me. But I know that could never happen. I climb onto the table next to Dr. Rankin, who's already standing there with a rod in her latex glove hand, eager to get to work. I take a breath to calm my insides as they tense at the sight. This will be even more unpleasant if I don't relax my muscles. I shuffle to get myself comfortable, the synthetic fabric rustling underneath me. Legs up, she instructs, not looking at my face, her focus purely on the task ahead as she lowers my knees into the usual position. I close my eyes as she stands between my legs and lifts the material protecting my modesty, starting the examination. The coldness of the rod as it enters makes my brain shudder. When she angles it in different directions and tugs at my insides, I want to vomit. I clench my jaw to stop the bile rising. We've lost one, Dr. Rankin murmurs, a few moments later, holding the stick in one position, then firmly guiding it into another. What? Vivian marches over to the screen. I'm not sure whether she's angry with me for having lost it or Dr. Rankin for failing to collect it. We still have the other, Dr. Rankin says, with a little more joy in her voice than usual. Although if we'd left it any later, we'd have lost that one too. I said for her to come in every day. We had a situation and her safety was more important, Vivian states, not bothering to look away from the screen in front of her as she greedily eyes my one egg that's ripe and ready for the picking. Dr. Rankin doesn't respond, but I hear the clanking of equipment next to me, letting me know she's about to go on to the next stage. Is this how it used to work? I ask suddenly, to no one in particular. Pardon? Asks Dr. Rankin, after a brief pause. For women before me. A stillness settles over the room. I can only imagine they're wondering how to respond. I used to ask a barrage of inappropriate questions when I was younger, not knowing they were so. Then I asked questions because I knew they were inappropriate. But now? Now I just want to know what I'm saving by bringing more life into the world. The procedure was similar, replies Dr. Rankin, her tone indifferent. So you all know what it feels like to be sitting here, to be laid bare and exposed, to feel like you're nothing more than a piece of meat, I say, waiting to be stopped as I look at them all. I'm so used to Vivian shooting me down, it's become a habit to push her until I'm reprimanded. I'm surprised she hasn't scolded me on this occasion, Although as Dr. Rankin is still going about her business, I doubt Vivian cares too much about what comes out of my mouth. She's not even looking at me. I've experienced this many times. I know what you're going through, Mother Cardi replies tenderly, her hands wiping down the sides of her black dress, highlighting the curve of her hips. But it'll be over soon, Eve. How many times? I ask, my tone more forceful and direct with her than usual. She struggles, looking from me to Vivian. How many times did they put your legs in stirrups and strip you of your dignity? I ask. You asked for it to be done in this way, Eve. Vivian cuts in, her voice calm, as though she's talking to a child. Koa is still here if you'd like me to bring him in. I'm sure he'd enjoy that very much. Once you were pregnant, when you birthed your boys, I continue to Mother Cardi, ignoring Vivian. How long did they wait for you to recover before you were forced back onto a table like this? Mother Cardi's eyes widen imploringly, begging me to stop. I want to carry on, but a burning sensation in my lower body makes me yelp in pain. I stop. Squeezing my eyes shut, I feel my chest deflate as a single tear rolls down my cheek. This is no different from what I usually experience. It's no more painful. There's nothing new. But it is. Because I know that if this is successful, it's just the start. It's not a case of fertilizing my egg and leaving me with a child to bring up. It's going to be a never-ending cycle. It'll be repeated until I'm no longer of use to them. I just want to know what to expect, I say, through gritted teeth. What my life is going to be like. You've had your life, Eve. We've given you everything. Entertainment, education, a friend. Just look at this place, this world we've made for you. Now it's time for you to give back. You do your duty. You bear us a future of girls, and you'll live your life doing much the same as before. And what kind of future will they have? Best not to concern yourself with that, Vivian quips, her eyes rolling with annoyance. You need to play your part in Destiny's game first. Destiny. I repeat the word in my head a few times. Destiny. What is my destiny? Is it my destiny to be treated like a breeding bitch for everyone else's benefit? Or is the fact that Bram found me, and that we shared such a strong connection, despite being separated by a man-made illusion, part of it? Perhaps Mother Nature will toy with us again and stop us humans from making the same mistakes, from intervening in her plans for us. Mistakes. I've always known I'm lumbered with a huge responsibility, but the thinking behind any decisions surrounding my mission has never been mine. It's never been about me. But what if Mother Nature chose for me to be laden with this duty for a reason? What if Bram and I were meant to meet? What if this is all about free will and the beauty of human nature? The power of instinct? Mistakes. I've always wanted this course of treatment to fail, but what if it succeeds? Will I have failed in my destiny? Mistakes. I can't stop thinking about my children and the lives they will lead. More than that, I wonder what my parents would think if they could see me now. Would they have wanted this life for me? Would they have chosen it? Mistakes. I know my mum would be mortified to see me like this, just as I will be to see any daughters of mine lying on this bed in years to come. I said you can go, Vivian barks at me, bringing my focus back into the room. We'll call for you when you're needed again. The procedure is over. Dr. Rankin has already gone, taking my egg to be fertilized to start the process of life. Even before it's put back inside me, that little being has started its own journey to becoming a real person. Mistakes. It's time to test the world they've made for me.
Chapter 48. Bram. We sail away from Central. Travel is slow as we avoid areas patrolled by the EPO, which means staying out of sight as much as we can. It was easier where the buildings were tall and the river and canals between them were busy. Out here, these pods stand out.
We don't want any attention. As the buildings become less frequent, sections of sloppy mud break the surface, with an occasional patch of dull green sprouting. The 12 heads of the men who make up our team are turned towards the grassy mounds. They're staring at this rare sight.
Tree!
Chubbs calls, waving at the barely visible leaves just poking through the mist ahead.
Not far, Frost says. There's no need to use the intercom, as our engines are near silent now that we're sailing so slowly and so close together.
As the pollution mist clears, more trees appear ahead of us, stepping out of the fog like the ghosts of a time we left behind, a time we destroyed. A great barricade emerges ahead, stretching as far as I can see on either side.
It's the boundary, grunts Frost. This is as far as the EPO wants you to come.
As the mist clears, I see those three letters again. EPO. Surrounded by warnings. Radiation. Explosives. Toxic waste. You name it, the sign is there. Plastered all over the rusted metal barricade.
Inviting? Chubbs jokes.
Is it safe? Saunders asks. We stare at the fog beyond the border, tinged with a slight green hue.
Looks safe enough for trees, I reply. Course is bloody safe, Frost laughs. This is all smoke and mirrors, kid. The EPO trying to keep us in one place, where they can watch us.
Move on,
I signal, and our pods press forward, floating through the large gaps between the partially submerged barricade. The further we go, the more we feel Mother Nature reaching out to us. Only the tops of the taller trees are visible at the moment, their highest branches piercing the surface like arms stretching up to a sun that barely shines, a few dull green leaves fluttering from them. Mother Nature is tough. Through the floodwater beneath us, I see a sunken street. The red tiles of rooftops, the black paint of streetlights. Further down, there's a bench, now wrapped in reeds and plant life.
The water's pretty clear here, I say to Saunders. Fewer people, less pollution, he explains, and I nod as a school of fish swims underneath our pods, still visible through the glass floor.
I take a breath of air. Real air. It hasn't been filtered or tampered with. It isn't full of pesticides and chemicals to sterilize it, just simple, natural air. It feels wonderful and cold in my lungs. Suddenly, our pod jolts and I'm thrown forward, just managing to stop my face smashing against the front handrail. I stand and see everyone else recovering.
We've hit land,
I call, as I catch sight of the watery earth pressed up against the glass pod beneath my feet.
We can walk from here.
We jump into the knee-deep water, our boots and waterproof flood suits keeping out the wet but not the cold. It's uncomfortable but not unbearable. We group together in the bow of the leading pod where Johnny, the most eager member of my new team, is reading a handheld GPS unit.
How old is that thing? I ask.
Older than any of us, but it's reliable and can't be traced by the drones, Johnny says,
through the strands of hair covering his face, not taking his eyes off the old-fashioned touchscreen display.
We're about a mile from where that photo was taken, if the building still exists. It's right there on the map, says Chubbs, pointing at it, clearly visible in the bird's eye view on Johnny's GPS.
Yeah, but these maps are BE, about 40 years old, dumbass. Look, there's no floodwater, he says.
All right, let's keep our heads together. We don't know exactly what we're walking into here, I say to them, taking the GPS from Johnny.
Sorry, sir, he says nervously.
It's okay,
I reassure him. I wish he'd stayed in the deep. His youth and his keenness to impress me aren't helpful.
Let's move in single file. I'll lead,
I say, and set off towards the little red blip on the GPS monitor. As we walk, the ground under our feet rises and falls, the depth of the water varying from ankle to waist deep. The closer we get, the more trees rise before us. Before we know it, we're walking along an old man-made path. It's like nothing any of us have ever seen before. The men walk silently, taking it all in, everything seeming calm. I kick something hard, floating in the water. I turn it over with my foot. It's a signpost. Saunders passes it down the line following us. Grimm's Ditch, I read aloud.
This is the place. We're here.
I look ahead,
and see a break in the trees off the path to the right. As we approach, my heart is pounding. "There it is," I whisper. A gentle wind is blowing through the deep green leaves of the tree I've stared at for years. Now I'm here, it's even more beautiful. Despite the surrounding conditions, the grey skies and the foot of water it now stands in, it's still as elegant and graceful as I could ever have hoped it would be. I step closer, remove my glove, and touch its rough, damp bark. The freevers group around me and admire it too. No one can deny the majesty of a tree, especially one that has survived these conditions, stood its ground against everything humans have thrown at it. It makes me think of Eve. "We're not alone," Chubb says, noticing a figure standing in the doorway of the brick building, about 20 meters away from us. "It's a woman." The men scramble to get a clearer view. "Calm yourselves," Frost orders, fierce and authoritative. He shoots me a look. Helena was right. It's a sanctuary. "You're not permitted to be here," she calls to us across the flooded pathway. She's concealed beneath a long gown and her grey hair is cut short. "You must leave at once." Frost looks at me. "Well, Captain," he says quietly, "you wanted to lead us." I take a step towards the frail woman.
"I warn you, this is a sanctuary. We are legally protected. Miss, I apologize for turning up like this. I know it's against protocol, but we're soldiers from the EPO.
She stares at me. Her watery blue eyes twitch from my face to my waterproofs to the gun hanging over my shoulder. I slowly pull it off, and she instantly raises a shotgun concealed beneath her robes. The men behind me raise their weapons at her.
"Whoa!" I cry, turning my back on the old woman, raising my arms at the freevers. "Weapons down, now!"
They hesitate, their eyes flickering from their target to Frost.
"You heard him, men. Weapons down," Frost says.
"Apologies, sir." He flashes my arm a subtle look, and I understand instantly what our next move is.
"Let's start again. I am Captain Bram Wells, a senior officer at the Extinction Prevention Organization."
I start taking small steps towards the old woman, her wrinkles becoming more defined the closer I get. I turn my weapon around and offer it to her. "We're here to collect something that belongs to us." She pauses, gun still aimed at my chest. Her eyes search mine deeply, searching for truth. I slowly unzip my heavy waterproof jacket, not losing eye contact with her. I open it and reveal the name badge on my EPO jumpsuit. She takes a moment to read it and think.
"Wells?" she asks.
I nod.
"As in Dr. Isaac?" she says.
My heart skips. She knows my father.
We're in the right place.
"My father," I explain, and I see her shoulders rise as she takes a deep breath before releasing it.
"You scared the hell out of us, showing up unannounced. There's a schedule for visits for a reason, you know. I could have blown your head off, young man," she says as she lowers her gun.
"I'm sorry this is unscheduled. It's something of an emergency. We need to see him. Is he here?" I ask, and she turns to look at me suspiciously.
"Is he here?"
"Of course he's here. Where else is he going to be?" she asks. But before I can answer, she speaks again. "Well, I don't know why they always send so many of you. You know the protocol here, 2 men at a time. Leave your weapons at the door." She turns and steps inside the house. I look at Frost and beckon him over with a nod. He takes off his gun and hands it to Saunders, then comes across to me.
"So far, so good,"
I whisper. "Keep your wits about you, kid.
If he's really here, this place is going to be watched by more than an old lady with a shotgun," he replies, as we step over a wall of sandbags and follow her into the sanctuary.
Chapter 49. Eve. We stand in silence for a few moments, once the doctor and Vivian have left. I need time to process how I'm feeling. I close my legs, my hospital gown rustling as I slip off the table and find myself clutching Mother Cardi's shoulder. Her dainty arms are crossed over her body, but her hand finds mine and pats it gently. "Well done," she whispers sympathetically, her eyes telling me she understands how I feel after such an invasive procedure. I'm glad that's the case, but she doesn't know what's going on in my head. Yes, I feel violated, but the fire that was already lit within me is roaring now. The flames flicker and burst, telling me it's time. I turn to make my way back to my safe haven of a bedroom, but before I can leave, my eye is caught by something. I want a shower, I say to Mother Cardi. Of course. Let's go back to your room. She's gathering the clothes I discarded earlier. No, here will do, I tell her, walking to the shower in the corner. Before she can advise me not to, I yank off my gown, tossing it to the side in my hatred for everything it represents. It drops to the floor in a crumpled heap. Wash my hair, I say, glancing back at her confused face, opening the glass door to the shower and twisting on the water. My body tingles as I walk under the hot jet and feel the water running over my skin. She's with me in seconds, her fingers running through my hair and massaging my scalp. Where are the labs? I whisper, loud enough for only her to hear, while being careful not to look directly at her. Sorry, I hear her mumble, having been caught off guard. We're not in my room now. Perhaps she doesn't feel quite so safe revealing things she shouldn't, but I need to know now, while I could potentially act on my findings. The doctor, where would she have gone? This level? I hiss. All I hear for a few seconds is the water splashing in the cubicle. I'm about to ask again when I hear her soft reply. Outside. Turn right. Third door on the left. Am I spot by the stream? I ask, looking up at her. Mother Cardi's eyes widen, not in a way that tells me she's surprised I'm asking the question, but rather that I'm asking at this particular moment. I need to be sure it's not another lie, I tell her. Level 800. All of it, she says quickly. My jaw clenches as I look away from her. It's not even near ground level. How can I get there? The lift. There's no chance of that, I say dismissively. This place was built for you, she hisses. Just say the number. I think I must have misheard her, but her tone fills me with confidence. But Eve, they'll come after you. They'll let them, I say firmly, trying to work out the best course of action. Let me come with you. No, absolutely not, I say, looking up at her earnest face. She lowers her head sadly in agreement, and I bow mine in return. She doesn't need to be more involved than I've already made her. She washes the suds out of my hair. I'm grateful for her speed. I need to act fast, and I know she understands. Once I'm out of the shower, Mother Cardi wraps me in a white towel, and I feel her squeezing my arms tightly as she dries me. I'm not sure whether it's an encouragement or offered as a warning, but I'm hoping it's the former. My legs shake as I step into my knickers, then the khaki dress she holds out for me. I try to move quickly, but without making it look like I'm rushing, realizing someone could be watching. I can't be seen to act frantically or out of character. I don't want to raise suspicion or attract attention any sooner than necessary. I swoop my wet hair into a topknot while Mother Cardi helps me with my knee-high black boots. Did I leave my necklace in the shower? I ask her. What necklace? She asks, looking suitably confused. I rarely wear jewelry. Will you have a look for me? It's the one with my birthstone on it, I say, my hand going to my chest as though it's a treasured possession. She doesn't even frown as she goes along with what I've asked. As soon as she steps into the cubicle, I shut it after her, pulling a unit of medical equipment across to block her exit. Eve, she whispers, her open palm resting against the glass between us, her eyes wide and shiny. Sorry, I mumble, then turn and head for the door. It's not that I don't trust her, but it's the only way I can be sure they won't think she's in on it. I catch sight of myself in the reflection of the mirrored wall and see the determination on my face. I don't know how the panic I'm experiencing isn't displayed there, because my insides are churning at the thought of what I want to achieve in the next couple of minutes. Seeing the look on my face spurs me on. I'm stronger than I know. I can do this. I turn the handle and open the door. My heart in my mouth as I step out into what has become the unknown, expecting to see someone waiting there or a crowd of security guards stopping me going any further. Instead, There is nothing but the sterile blue corridor I walked along earlier. I turn right and pass the third door on the left where I now know the lab is. I have to do something else first. I go straight to the lift. It's already waiting when I get to it, but when I step inside and a robotic voice asks where to, I say words I've never said before. Level 800. My garden, I hear myself say. As you wish, Eve. The doors close and my heart spins at the realization that we are traveling downwards. It doesn't swell like it usually does when I'm on the way to my little spot outside. Instead, it tightens in trepidation of what I'll find there. The journey takes a couple of minutes, as long as it usually does when I'm permitted to go outside. But the only journeys I have to compare it with are those to the encounters and for examinations, both of which must take place far closer to where they keep me, because they take just a few seconds. The lift slows to a stop, and the doors open on what should be the collection bay. It's pitch black, and I notice I'm not hit by a wave of fresh, chilly air as usual. Instead, there's nothing. No change in the atmosphere at all. I know there's no turning back, so I force myself to take a few steps out of the lift. As I do so, light ripples across the space in front of me, showing me the collection bay, but not as I know it. The lighting is harsher and not as inviting. The usual black car is waiting in front of me, its door open and ready, but without Ketch beside it, like he was the last time I was here. I close the door I usually get into and walk around to the driver's seat. I've never driven before, or watched anyone else do it, but as I climb in and look at the space around me, I realize it isn't going to be a problem. A button has the word ON engraved into the dark metal. I press it, knowing I don't have long. The car roars into life. The only other gadgets I can see are a black leather wheel directly in front of me and two pedals at my feet. I press one, and nothing happens. But when I place my foot on the other, the vehicle flies forward and wobbles, thanks to my hands grabbing the wheel, which I can see will steer me where I want to go. I take my foot off the floor and notice the car begin to slow. I press the other pedal and come to an abrupt stop. Okay, I think. This is okay. Go. Stop. Steer. That's all you've got to remember. As I take a breath, I spot shadows in the little mirror slightly above me, which is angled so that I can see behind. Someone's coming. With that knowledge, I place my foot on the go pedal and propel myself far from them, my hands gripping the steering wheel in an effort to keep control. I don't know where I'm going, but straight and away seems good. Within seconds, I'm out of the collection bay. There's nothing but dull grey concrete all around me. I keep going. Then I notice lines that have been painted on the floor in bright yellow. It's hard not to laugh. I always knew when we were close to my little garden, and I knew the whole route we took to get there. My body memorized every bump and turn that meant I was getting closer to my little haven. They must have known that. Poor little gullible Eve. In the distance, I can see a clump of green and notice that the end of the maze on the floor will eventually lead me there. I decide not to go by their usual pointless route and take a shortcut. It's only when I see the height of the trees that I observe the height of the ceiling above me. The space is gargantuan. There's a clear break in the man-made forest for me to drive through, and it isn't long before the path becomes uneven, causing the car to jitter. I put my foot slowly on the brake, so that I'm not in danger of veering off the track, but still moving. And then I see it. The place where the car usually stops before I step out of my padded cell to take in the natural beauty. I want to slow down, to get out and take in the falsehood of the piece of outside they gave me to fulfill my inquisitive mind. I want to rip apart the leaves and see what they're made of. I want to hunt for the pump that engineers my perfect stream and the lights overhead that make it all seem so magical when it's nothing but a fabrication. This is what I want to do, but I can't. My hands are so tightly on the wheel, my foot so clamped to the floor. Stop, Eve. Stop now. Vivian's voice is so loud that I think she's in the car with me. I gasp, but keep my eyes ahead of me and focus on my steering. I know she isn't here, but her voice is being played in the man-made heartless void of level 800. I'd thought this place was special. but it was just another part of their trap to keep me here, unquestioning, so that I live my life as they've always wanted me to. It's another form of manipulation, another lie. At least I always knew Holly was a figment of someone's imagination. This trickery seems far crueler. I don't know what is real anymore. Do they really want me to become a brainless dummy so they can do as they like without me wanting things for myself? Would it make life easier for all of us? I push my foot down harder and accelerate. The car growls in response, pushing me back in my seat. You are breaching national security. We will be forced to take drastic measures if you do not come to an immediate stop, Eve. Vivian barks. Go for it, I snarl. It's not like I can actually go anywhere. A bump from behind causes my chest to bash against the steering wheel. With my concentration gone, the car gains a mind of its own. I struggle to regain control. Another hit from behind causes it to spin to the left. The fake shrubbery gets under its nose and propels me upwards. For a brief second, I fly. Then I flip. I see the tree ahead moving closer and closer in slow motion. We collide. I hear a bang, a crack, and a thump as my head makes contact with something hard. The glass around me shatters. There is no smell of jasmine. No sound of birds singing or the stream cascading through the meadow. Eve! She shouts. Just her.
Chapter 50. Bram. It's okay, ladies. It's just the EPO springing another not-so-routine visit on our guest. The old lady calls up the stairs to where a dozen or so equally wrinkled faces look down on us. I smile at them, but no one smiles back. Some turn away in disgust, and I hear sobs from a room above us. Don't mind them. They never take too kindly to the men the EPO send to check on Mr. Warren. The woman's words fill my veins with fire. He is here. We have found him. Now we just have to keep our cover and get him out of this place. Would you gentlemen care for a drink? She asks. No thanks, miss. It's Mrs. Sutcliffe, but you can call me Anne, she tells Frost with a twinkle in her eye. She might be old, but there's a feisty youthfulness about her. We'd just like to see Ernie and get out of your way as fast as we can, I tell her. Very well. He's downstairs. I'll leave you to it. The door's open. She gestures to where the stairs wrap around on themselves and disappear into a basement. Frost and I look at each other. The door is open. I take the lead and walk down to the lower floor. The sight that greets us takes my breath away. It's a vast open space with long wooden floors that stretch the entire length of the building. The brick walls are lit by soft bulbs, giving warmth to what is essentially a cellar. At the far end of the room, two windows look out at a beach, where transparent waves crash against the white sand. Suddenly, it vanishes and a lush rainforest stands in its place. Sunlight pierces the deep greens, and the ultra-realistic views on these screens help to create the illusion that this isn't just a basement with no windows and one door. As we step into the room, I see a worn leather sofa with deep seat marks on the cushions. A table is piled high with paperwork and littered with half-empty mugs full of cigarette butts. A small single bed stands across the room, near a toilet and a bath. A man is shaving in the mirror by the wash basin. Gentlemen, Ernie says as he shaves the fine grey hair around his upper lip. Mr. Warren, I begin. Mr. Warren? It's been a while since anyone's called me that. You must be new. Shall we get this over with? He washes the shaving cream from his chin and pulls a white vest over his wrinkled body. I'm not sure what I was expecting to find, but it definitely wasn't this man. After all the stories, all the rumours surrounding the dangerous, mentally unstable individual who had to be sectioned and sedated, this one standing before us, taking a seat in his well-worn spot on the Chesterfield, seems normal. He sits back and holds out his wrist to us. Frost and I look blankly at each other. Well, quick as you like, chaps. Arthritis doesn't make this too comfortable, you know, Ernie says. After a second or two, he relaxes his arm and looks at us. Are you going to check this damn thing or not? He says.
pointing to a small scarred patch of skin on the side of his wrist. "I'm sorry, Mr. Warren, but today isn't going to be like our normal visits," I say. "Oh? Why is that, boy? My goodness, how old are you? Do they really let kids come and do this now?" he asks, talking to himself more than to us.
"We're leaving," Frost says, "and you're coming with us."
Ernie is dead still. He looks up at Frost, and then me. His eyes drop to the EPO patch on my chest.
"Leaving?"
he asks. "Yes, right now. We have a lot to explain, but not here," I say.
"Where are we going?"
the old man says, sounding concerned.
"We had a deal. I've not tried to escape again. I've not left this room. I've done everything you've told me.
Is it Eve? Is she all right?" He grabs my arms, worry written on his tired face. I glance around the room and see photos of Eve on every surface. Newspaper articles, magazines, pencil drawings. Every bit of table space, every spare chair is covered with them. My heart aches for him. The man who lost his daughter. "Eve is fine," I say, placing a hand on his shoulder to calm him. "We just need to move you somewhere safer. Grab anything vital that you need and let's go."
"So, you're going to take this out then?"
Ernie says, pointing to the scar on his wrist again.
"Take what out?"
I ask. Ernie stares at us. His wrinkles rearrange themselves and I can almost hear the questions inside his head.
"You're not from the EPO, are you?"
he says slowly, his veiny hand trembling slightly. I feel Frost look at me. There's no time to muck around.
"No, we're not," I say. "We've come for you, and then we're going to free your daughter."
The old man takes a moment to absorb what I've said, then slumps back into the sofa, cupping his hands over his face.
"No, no, no," he says through his fingers. "They'll already be on their way."
"Who will?" Frost barks.
"Them! The EPO! What? Did you think they just locked me away down here and forgot about me? They're watching us right now! All of us!"
He raises a bony finger to a patch of ceiling directly over our heads. Frost and I look up to see a 360-degree camera staring down at us, still and cold, its small red light blinking with each subtle movement we make.
"Shit," says Frost. "We've not got long."
"We need to leave right now," I tell Ernie.
"You're not listening to a word I'm saying. I can't leave. Not unless they remove this thing in my arm,"
Ernie says, waving it at us.
"What's in your arm?" I ask.
"It's an explosive, isn't it?" Frost says.
"More than that, it's the trigger," Ernie tells us.
"The trigger for what?"
"For the rest of the explosives,"
Anne says from the stairs behind us. I turn and come face to face with the barrel of her shotgun again.
"What explosives?" I ask.
"This building is not what you think it is," Anne replies simply, as she tightens her grip on the weapon to steady her aim. "If he leaves that door, boom, he kills us all. He's the trigger and this whole house is the bomb. They figured it was the only way to stop him trying to escape."
"This isn't a sanctuary, it's a prison," Frost barks.
My blood boils.
How could they keep him here like this? How could they put these poor women through such torture?
"Why don't you all leave? Together," I ask.
"And go where? They'd find us. We'd all be killed," Anne replies.
"Can't we cut it out?" Frost says, studying Ernie's scarred arm. "Not unless you know how to disarm it. It has sensors on it. It knows if you cut it out and it'll set them all off," Ernie says.
"We need Johnny," I tell Frost.
But suddenly, the ceiling above us is vibrating. Dust falls through the cracks in the floorboards, and the threatening hum of arriving airships rumbles down the stairs.
"They're here," Ernie says.
Muffled gunshots ring out from above, and the sound of men shouting is just audible over the noise of an airship hovering somewhere above.
"I can't let you take him. You'll kill us all," Anne says again, looping her finger around the trigger of her weapon.
"We need to get out of here fast," Frost says.
"I didn't come all this way to leave him behind now," I shout over the sound of bullets hitting the bricks of the house above. "You can't take me. People have tried and failed so many times. They all have the same fate, boy, and you're too young for that yet,"
Ernie says, with a worn kindness in his voice, the voice of someone with no fight left.
"Get out now."
"He's right, Bram," Frost says to me. "We've got to leave him."
"No,"
I shout back.
"I'm not leaving him here."
I stare Frost in the eye, his heavy body towering over me.
If we leave now, they'll move him and we'll never find him again.
Frost's eyes don't leave mine. He's trying to read me, trying to see how far I'll go for this man, for Eve. I don't budge.
There is one way to do it,
Ernie says, interrupting our stare-off.
Ernie, no,
Anne whispers sharply. He shrugs away her plea and points to Frost's boot.
I don't suppose either of you has a knife,
he asks.
They're unarmed,
Anne replies, but Frost is already reaching inside the lip of his heavy boot and unsheathing a small machete.
Do it quick and don't feel bad. I'm tougher than I look. Tried doing it myself years ago, but they caught...
Ernie doesn't get the chance to finish the sentence before Frost raises the blade over his head.
Wait!
Anne calls, dropping her gun and reaching out towards Frost, but her old legs can't get there fast enough. He swipes in one swift, heavy movement, cleanly slicing off the old man's arm from the elbow down. I jump to Ernie's side, pulling off my belt and strapping it tight around his upper arm. The scarred patch containing the trigger sits lifeless on the floor at his feet.
Shit, Frost,
I say, my words barely coming out through the shock of what he just did. Frost bends down and carefully picks up Ernie's lower arm. He pulls off his own belt and ties it impossibly tightly around the end as blood seeps out of it. Anne covers her mouth with trembling hands, trying to process what is happening.
Gotta keep this warm,
Frost growls as he rips a wool blanket from the chair opposite us and neatly wraps it around Ernie's amputated wrist. He walks towards the far wall, near the sink, and places the arm on the towel rail.
Don't turn the heating off.
Chapter 51. Bram. We pull Ernie up the stairs, keeping his bloody stump raised. As we enter the landing, the front door bursts open and our freevers fill the hall, followed by a shower of bullets across the front of the house. We duck for cover. The women's screams pierce my ears worse than the bullets.
What the hell happened?
Saunders asks, rushing over to help lift the old man.
I'll explain later. We've got to get him out of here now.
We hoist Ernie up and move through the rooms to the back of the house.
They've landed,
Chubbs cries, as he takes aim through a broken window at the front of the house and fires.
There has to be another way out, I say to Saunders. That way.
Ernie's weak voice stutters as he motions to a corridor off to our left.
Let's go, follow me,
I call to the men behind me as they begin returning fire through the windows and doorway at the front of the house.
Frost, we need to leave now.
A scatter of shrapnel shakes the house like an earthquake. The flash blinds us momentarily, and the high-pitched tone drowns all other sound. As my sight returns, I glance around to check Ernie. My heart stops at the sight.
Man down!
Chubbs cries. Frost is kneeling over a bloodied body. It's not Ernie.
It's Johnny, Saunders cries, looking back too.
Johnny's lifeless body lies on the wooden floor. Frost gently places his large palm on his forehead, and I see tears pour from his eyes and disappear into his beard.
It's his son,
Saunders whispers, the words catching in his throat. I know, I croak back, barely. I can hardly watch. Johnny, this is my fault. I brought them here. My heart aches for him, for them both. But in that moment of sadness, among all the mayhem, I'm suddenly overcome with a strange admiration. Like I'm witnessing some beautiful event, tragic, of course, but beautiful. Seeing the love of a father for his son at its most extreme, pouring out of him in a flood of tears, his voice screaming at the sky. To feel this kind of love is something I'll never know. Frost stands, picking up his and Johnny's guns before marching to the door.
No, Frost!
I cry, handing Ernie's weight to Saunders. I run towards him as fast as I can, but don't get to him before he steps out onto the front porch and opens fire. Between the flashes from his gun, I see the approaching EPO squad scramble for cover. Frost's vengeful rampage takes down one, two, three men. Then I see him. Ketch.
He sees me too. Our eyes meet before an explosion between us sends mud and water flying 20 feet into the air. Frost shields his eyes and I use the distraction to grab the hood of his jacket and yank him back inside. Chubbs comes to my side and helps drag